Welcome to Eye to Eye, the podcast of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists. My name is Sunil Mamtora, and I will be your host. Today, I'm speaking with Piers Keane, a consultant ophthalmologist who works at the Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, and a leader in, if not the leader, in artificial intelligence in ophthalmology. Piers, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really, really appreciate it. And before we actually talk about artificial intelligence and all the really interesting topics that the listeners really want to hear about, I was just wondering if you could tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Hi, Sunil. Well, just to tell you, it's an absolute pleasure to come on this podcast, and you know, I'm really looking forward to discussing things with you in the next half hour or so. So my background, as some of the listeners can probably tell, is that I'm originally from Ireland. I went to medical school in Dublin and did my initial ophthalmology training there. So I spent 3 years doing ophthalmology in Ireland, and then I decided to take some time out to do research, and I moved to Los Angeles for 2 years, and I did research into OCT imaging at the Doheny Eye Institute in Los Angeles. So I had like an amazing time working there and was able to work with some world leaders in the field of OCT. And after that, I essentially moved to the UK. And so first of all, I took up a 1 year post in the West Midlands, and then I was successful in getting an NIHR clinical lecturer post in Moorfields. And so essentially I've been working at Moorfields for more than 10 years now. So I started there in 2010 and I became a consultant in Moorfields in 2015. And so that may be kind of a little bit long-winded summary, but essentially where I am now is that I'm a consultant in the medical retina service at Moorfields, and I wear another hat in that I'm an associate professor at the Institute of Ophthalmology at University College London. So I'm a clinical academic. And then maybe the last thing to say about me is that I'm funded by UK Research and Innovation, by UKRI, and I'm funded as a Future Leaders Fellow. And the reason that I highlight this is that I'm just really privileged that I have this funding, so that it means that 80% of my time is protected for research. And so essentially I do Monday to Thursday, I do sort of research work, and then I do 1 day a week in the medical retina clinics at Moorfields. And so for me, this is a dream job. And if anybody who's listening ever wants to kind of hear about it, or any tips that I could pass on about clinical academic careers, then I'm always super, super happy to engage.
That's amazing. So you still see patients then?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I love to see patients. And I love, I guess one of the nice things is that I can go in on a Friday and I've got clinic all day, and I don't have to worry about, for the most part, worry about meetings. I don't really have to worry about answering emails. I just see patients. And I feel privileged in that I can like really give all my energy to the patients and just really look after them and give them a kind of personalized care, which I sometimes wonder if it would be harder for me to do that if I was just working every single day, really long hours on the clinical side, because, you know, it's just, you know, as you know, extremely tiring when you have to do something like that.
That's really, really interesting. And I don't think I've ever heard that perspective before. And I think it makes you realize that, you know, when you're seeing patients, you know, in a lower proportion of the time you otherwise would, it makes you really appreciate that time.
I love it. And I think the other important perspective for me is that it really informs all of the research that I do. And so it's like the value that I can add in artificial intelligence, because I'm not a computer scientist, I'm not an engineer, but a large part of the value is actually identifying new and novel applications for artificial intelligence in the context of ophthalmology, or more broadly in healthcare. And that's kind of like the gold in some ways, because sometimes it sounds kind of easy, but actually finding that like that application is the most valuable thing. Because, you know, the engineers and the computer scientists at a company like DeepMind, you know, amazing although they are, they would never be able to do that, because they're not really in the trenches and actually seeing patients.
It gives you the ideas then. That's really interesting. So, you know, with regards to artificial intelligence, AI, you know, when I think of AI and ophthalmology, the first thing that I think of is fundus photographs. Mm. And I've been to many of your lectures and lectures and talks by other people who talk about the use of fundus photography, you know, potentially diagnosing patients' ages, genders, refraction. Mm. And you know, AI is even being used by the DRSS in Scotland, if I'm not mistaken, to help to grade fundus photographs. But your most recent papers and publications are now taking things to another level. I don't know whether it's fair to say the next level, but I think a different level, mm. which is, you know, the interpretation of OCT. Mm. Could you tell us a bit about that?
I think it would be important to give kudos to all the amazing work that's being done in color fundus photography in diabetic retinopathy screening, as you've mentioned. I think part of the reason why that work has been at the forefront is because actually, you know, in the last decades, there have been large data sets of diabetic retinopathy data sets that have been made publicly available, things like the IPACS and MESIDOR data sets that were made publicly available. And that meant that it just stimulated all this machine learning research. So if you're like a computer scientist and you're exploring deep learning and you want to do something that's applied, you want to do something in healthcare, you look around for a public data set. And it turns out that the best public data sets were in ophthalmology and specifically were in diabetic retinopathy. And as a result of that, the very first autonomous AI system to ever receive FDA approval was for diabetic retinopathy screening, you know, from the company IDX, now known as Digital Diagnostics. And there's other companies such as iNuke who have gotten that. So definitely, you know, that just want to highlight that is in large part why ophthalmology is at the forefront across all medical specialties in this emerging field of AI-enabled healthcare. But you know, where I come in is OCT, as you mentioned. And I guess this sort of goes back to my background, which was that I had gone to Los Angeles at a time where OCT was still a relatively new technology. And I had been fortunate enough to work in Ireland in a department in Cork in the south of Ireland that had like a super early OCT device, like pre-Stratus OCT device, and just kind of fell in love with it. Went to Los Angeles, learned a lot about OCT, and then when I came to the UK, it was starting to pick up. And so I found myself, you know, even as a trainee being asked like, oh, how do you interpret this OCT scan? And I, you know, published work in this area. And then in that time, then sort of say 2010 to 2020, that it's like the use of OCT just shot up. So we're doing huge amounts of these images. And in fact, it's become the dominant modality. So we do more OCT imaging than all other ophthalmic imaging combined. And we have a situation in places like Moorfields where we're doing more than 1,000 OCT scans per day at Moorfields. So it seemed to me then that there was this kind of like nice Venn diagram where they have an overlap between huge amount of training data and real patient need, which was how do we actually have people with the right expertise to be able to look at these scans. And so that's what led me to initiate the collaboration between Moorfields and the artificial intelligence company DeepMind back in 2015, 2016.
Mm. So, you know, since 2016, how far have we come with regards to artificial intelligence being able to interpret and diagnose scans? I know your paper, you know, talked about a high success rate in terms of being able to diagnose OCT scans at the point of referral.
I think we've come a long way, but I think we still have a little bit of a journey to go. And that reflects the fact that actually going from an idea to an algorithm and then going from code to clinic, it turns out that that's like a super long journey. And so the timeline of what we've done so far at Moorfields is that essentially back in about 2015, I had been, you know, reading about all the latest advances in AI, and in particular this technique that's called deep learning. And I was trying to think of who I can collaborate with who has expertise in this area to help address this clinical issue. And I was looking for experts in the university and didn't really meet anybody who was interested or was met with shoulder shrugs. And then I was looking for collaborators in industry. And that's when I read this this profile of DeepMind in Wired magazine in July 2015. So that was a light bulb moment for me, because I read, part of the interview was with a guy called Mustafa Suleiman, one of the co-founders, and he's from London. His mother was a nurse in Barnet in the NHS, and he said that they were interested in applying AI for, you know, for real world benefit. So I essentially tracked him down on LinkedIn and sent him a message, initiated this collaboration. Then that led to some preliminary chats and talks. I was fortunate then to have like the amazing support of people like Serpeng Kaur at Moorfields, who probably everyone listening will be familiar with. That led to a research collaboration agreement in 2016. In 2018, we published the first results, and that was like our proof of concept. We published in Nature Medicine, and that was essentially showing this AI system that could look at macular OCT scans and could assess them for more than 50 different retinal diseases and then provide a triage decision for use potentially in rapid access macular clinics that have started to spring up and maybe in the future in community optometry settings. So that was 2018. Now, where we are in 2021 is that we're working to actually, as I say, to go from code to clinic. So just to be clear to the listeners, the system that we've developed is not yet being used in direct patient care at Moorfields. It is not yet a commercial product. And so what I've learned since publishing the paper is that it's a long journey to do that. You have to actually consider many things. You have to have the technical maturity of the algorithm. So like the piece of experimental code that forms the basis of a research paper in a journal is in no way something that could be actually used at scale by millions of people around the world. It has to be kind of like rewritten from the ground up to be able to do something like that. Then there's the clinical validation, because one of the things that our paper back in 2018 was like a retrospective clinical validation. It was high quality, but at the same time, it's not the same as doing a randomized clinical trial or other prospective studies. And so we've been doing a lot of clinical validation work to make sure that the algorithm, if it's trained on data from people in Moorfields, like a white Irish person in Moorfields, will it work as well in someone in Africa or South America or the US or other countries? And then, of course, the other big barrier is you have to get regulatory approval, FDA approval, MHRA, et cetera, et cetera. And then even once you get those approvals, you have to get some sort of payer approval, like who's going to pay for it? You know, our insurance company is going to cover it. Is NICE going to approve it? Is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare in the US, the CMS, going to pay for it, et cetera, et cetera? And then even once you have all of those, it's like, okay, well, are doctors going to use it? Or other healthcare professionals going to use it? And do we have the pathways to implement it? So again, a kind of extended answer to tell you that like this is a long process to go through, but I feel excited that we're within spitting distance of seeing something that will actually be deployed at scale for real world benefit.
Yeah, that's incredible. I loved to hear, you know, your journey of how you started things from just finding somebody on LinkedIn, dropping them a message and starting a conversation, because, you know, that's how the best things in the world happen.
Yeah, I think there's an art to it actually. And my timing was quite good, because as soon as the Moorfields collaboration was announced publicly, they started getting hundreds of people who were you know, trying to do that, to message them and kind of form collaborations. And then of course that wasn't possible. But I would just say for any trainees who are listening, you would be surprised what you can achieve by sending the right email to the right person. Even when I was a medical student, I was able to kind of like spend a summer in Johns Hopkins working on bionic eyes, the retinal prosthesis, just because I sent a cold email to the head of the project and said, can I come and spend a summer working with you guys? And similarly, I ended up going to Los Angeles for a couple of years just because of like emails, just saying hello and finding nice opportunities.
That's incredible. That's really, really amazing advice and quite inspiring. So your data was already quite strong in your 2018 paper, which looked at the ability for AI to act as a triage system for OCT scans. You know, has your algorithm strengthened since that time?
Yeah, so one of the things is that we actually did a spin-off paper, which we published in Nature Medicine in May 2020, and that was with an enhanced version of the algorithm, and it was more specifically aimed at developing an early warning system for age-related macular degeneration. And we essentially added some additional features that it could delineate on the OCT scans. And then we trained it to be able to detect what we called imminent conversion in the good eye. So the idea was, if you have patients who are receiving anti-VEGF injections in one eye for wet AMD, can the model look at the good eye and say, and at some point, like, put up a red flag and say, this person is going to imminently develop choroidal neovascularization in their good eye using deep learning? And if we can do that, maybe we can have some, like, early treatment in those eyes and, you know, mitigate the visual impairment that can occur.
Yeah, that's quite amazing. Do you see that potentially leading to people being treated with intravitreal injections almost prophylactically based upon the, you know, the outcome of the algorithm?
I think that's one of our hopes. I think there has been a couple of studies which have already looked at prophylactic use of anti-VEGF in the fellow eye. And so there was the PROCON study and the PREVENT study for aflibercept and ranibizumab. And those studies weren't successful in showing the benefit of prophylactic treatment. But the issue was that they were just essentially treating the fellow eye of all patients with wet AMD. They weren't identifying those patients that were at the highest risk using an approach such as AI. And the other thing was that with them was that they just gave injections that were quarterly. So what I would hope is that this early warning system would essentially identify a subset of patients that with very high specificity are likely to imminently convert, so in the next 6 months, and those would be considered for prophylactic treatment in the context of a clinical trial. Now, that could be anti-VEGF, that could be newer, longer-acting agents that have started to filter through, or that could be some sort of surgical implants, port delivery systems or other things like that, which could maybe prevent conversion from happening, or, as I say, you know, if it does happen, sort of reduce the results. But I should hasten to add, this would all have to be examined in the context of a clinical trial. It's not like we would just want to start injecting fellow eyes without a good evidence base for that.
Of course. That's really interesting. It kind of almost makes me think, well, you know, right now, the way we treat patients with wet AMD, you might use PRN regimens or treat and extend regimens. Maybe we can see an end to these types of regimens and switch to AI-based regimens so that we only treat people when they need to be. And even if that led to a 1% reduction in the number of injections we deliver, you know, the savings would be huge.
Well, I think that's a great point. I think one of the things that I've become really conscious of in the last few years, particularly as a consultant, is that AMD is a lifelong disease. And actually, the clinical trials for wet AMD are typically like 1 and 2 year outcomes. But the fact is that if a family member of mine got diagnosed with wet AMD tomorrow, and say that person was 70, they would probably be receiving injections, you know, for 10 years or more. And they would probably require 50, 60, 100 or more injections. And so one of the things I'm quite interested in is, can we use AI to predict treatment burden in those patients? So, like, if you're newly diagnosed with wet AMD and you're told, look, it's quite likely you're going to require injections for the next 10 years, and we predict that it's going to be 60 injections or 100 injections, then that might change the way you approach things. You might say, okay, in that case, maybe I'm interested in having some sort of longer acting implant, or maybe I'm interested in signing up for some sort of novel therapy in a clinical trial, or something like that. So I think we need to reframe the way that we think about AMD as a chronic disease.
So you mentioned earlier that Moorfields does over 1,000 OCT scans per day. And as you know, I drive a self-driving car using the Autopilot system. And Tesla have got their own Autopilot system. And the way that these systems learn and train, these companies employ hundreds of people to watch videos and annotate and draw on these videos and images to say, okay, well, here are lane lines, here are traffic cones, here are signs, and here are other cars. So is the training of OCT scans similar? How many scans do you need to go through to train a model reliably?
Yeah, I think that's you've put your finger on one of the major bottlenecks in all of artificial intelligence research, which is to say that AI is very good at something called supervised learning, where you essentially, go to a neural network and you say, here's an example of a cat, here's an example of a dog, and you repeat that process thousands or millions of times. And that's the same in healthcare. You need to be able to say, here's an example of diabetic retinopathy, here's referable, here's non-referable. Or you need to do something which is called segmentation, which is to say, at a pixel level, you say what's on the scan. So you say, here's an OCT, and we've delineated all the intraretinal fluid or all the subretinal fluid on the OCT volume, and then we teach the systems to do the same in a supervised learning approach. Now, the problem with that is that it requires meticulous attention to detail, and it requires that to be sustained over a long period of time. So, and then how do you do that if you've got millions of scans? And also, how do you do that if you've got an OCT scan with like 128 B scans in one volume? So a lot of this sort of secret sauce in terms of the success of the work we've done between Moorfields and DeepMind is that we have been able to put in the hard work and put in the time and put in the meticulous attention to detail, often over the course of like 1 or 2 years, to label the data, to create it in the form that we want. So to give you one example, we've done one study where we're validating the algorithm that we've created, and we spent about 50 hours segmenting one single OCT volume scan in patients with diabetic macular edema and in AMD. So that is thinking about looking at every single slice and delineating every tiny little microcyst, every little bit of epiretinal membrane, every little bit of drusen on the scan, and then repeating that process over and over again until we agree that this is like the best possible grading of this image. And that has been crucial to all the work that we've done. But at the same time, that's also a major barrier, because how do you scale that up for different diseases? How do you get people with the right expertise to do that sort of work? It's like if I ask some of the residents at Moorfields to do this, that some of the specialty trainees, they'll say, oh yeah, I'd love to be in like AI, so cool, I want to be involved in AI. But actually they find out it's not glamorous. And, after like a few months of drawing in cysts on OCT scans, then it's hard to maintain your enthusiasm. But that's the hard work that's required behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess the contrast to self-driving cars is that, you could have a center full of 100 people who are labeling lane lines and traffic cones, but actually you need expertise to be able to annotate OCT scans. And the other thing is, how transferable is your model to devices and images which haven't been captured using the same specific device that you trained your model in?
The generalizability of deep learning systems is a major area of research in the whole field and is not a solved problem by any means. So the viewers may or the listeners may not realize that deep learning is very powerful if it's exposed to a wide range, a large and diverse range of data, But if it's then trained on that data set and exposed to a different data set, which has a different distribution than the data it's been trained on, there is really no guarantee that it will work well at all. So what I mean to say is, suppose you've trained it on Topcon OCT scans, and then you want to run it on a Zeiss OCT or a Heidelberg OCT. To a human, they look pretty similar, but to a neural network, they probably look completely different. And actually, it won't work at all when you go from one to the other. One of the novelties of our paper was kind of coming up with an approach that allowed the system to transfer between OCT imaging vendors and reduce the risks of that. But I want to highlight that more broadly, this is still an issue for these systems. If you move to a different imaging device, like if you upgrade to a newer device, these systems may not work. Or if you change the environment, suppose like it's trained on data and retinal photographs are taken in a situation where the patient is always dilated and the lights are always turned off in the room, but then it's being used in an environment where the lights are always turned on in the room and the patients aren't always dilated. It's not guaranteed at all that it's going to work. And that speaks to some of the challenges of actually making this into something that will work in a robust and reliable and safe and fair and transparent way for clinical practice.
That's really interesting. And I suppose OCT technology itself is changing all the time. Swept source OCT, for example, is becoming more popular. And I would imagine that you'd have to be careful about considering whether you'd need to start from scratch. Could you share with the listeners, I don't know if you can, maybe you might not be able to, but could you share with the listeners your most recent research and what you're working on them at the moment, at this very moment in time?
There's lots of cool projects that I'm excited with, and I could probably waffle on for hours to you telling you all about them. There's a couple that are super exciting. The most exciting, I think, is around use of something called automated deep learning, which is something sometimes referred to as AutoML. And this is the idea now that all the major tech companies have developed platforms that essentially have drag and drop interfaces that allow people without any coding expertise to train their own deep learning systems, train their own AI systems. So for example, if you had 1,000 photos of cats and you had 1,000 photos of like your pet dog, you could upload them to one of these systems, and with the spreadsheet that says image number one is a cat, image number two is a dog, etc. And then you can hit train, and the system will develop a deep learning model that you can then test, and you can say, let me show you another picture of a cat and see whether you get it correctly or not. So that is, I think, so transformative. And so when we heard about these systems, we decided to try it ourselves with medical images. And we got publicly available medical images. We got skin cancer lesions, we got chest x-rays, we got OCTs, we got retinal photographs, all publicly available, so you don't have to worry about ethics or governance or anything like that. And essentially, we started using some of these systems, and you know, they're available from Google, from Amazon, from Apple, from Microsoft, and from others. And essentially, we started to get results that were comparable to state-of-the-art within days or weeks. And that for me is super exciting, because although I lead a clinical AI research group, I'm a clinician. I don't have any formal computer science or engineering training myself. And so we published the results of that in the Lancet Digital Health at the end of 2019. And then we just published about 2 weeks ago a paper in Nature Machine Intelligence, where we compare the different automated deep learning platforms from Amazon and Apple and Google and others. So I think that the implications of this are huge, because it will lead us to a new phase of AI-enabled healthcare, where it's actually people like you and me and the listeners who are central to the development and application of these systems. It's people like you and me who have access to the data. It's people like you and me and the listeners who actually will probably come up with the new ideas that will actually stimulate the next phase of this. And so that, like, as you can probably tell, I'm super, super excited about this technology.
And just one final question, if that's okay. And that is, you know, forgetting about the research at the moment and the current applications, you know, things move so quickly. You know, in my experience, I feel that in 1 year, things move more than the previous 5 years, in some cases. And you know, 10 years from now, where do you see artificial intelligence in ophthalmology? You know, perhaps, you know, slit lamp cameras interpreting findings and diagnoses in real time, or in surgery. What do you see as the future?
So what I see is, in the eye clinics of 2030, I see them still being super busy, and still probably like ophthalmologists missing their lunch break because we've got too many patients. But I see a situation where a patient comes into us and they have like five different types of advanced imaging. They have their genomic data, their metabolomic data, their proteomic data, their lipidomic data. They have information from home monitoring app that they've got in their phone, from they have information about the pollution levels in their community over the last few months since the last visit, and a range of other information. And what I would imagine is that we will have like a number of narrow AI tools that help us make sense of each of those things. So we'll have an AI tool that helps us make sense of their imaging, an AI tool that makes sense of their genetic material. And we will then, as clinicians, have to bring together all of that information to make the best decisions for our patients. You know, for me, that's really exciting and transformative. And, you know, I, for one, am really excited to be involved in it.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. And I think in ophthalmology, I feel that we're lucky because our specialty, you know, with its heavy imaging background, lends itself more easily to being assisted by artificial intelligence technology.
Yeah. But remember, these technologies are exciting, but they're not magic. There's some areas where they'll work well. There's some areas where they won't work well. And this is not a technology that's going to replace doctors anytime soon. But hopefully it should greatly increase, greatly enhance the way that we can deliver care to our patients.
Yeah. Well, Piers, thank you so much for joining me today. I've learned so much and it's been amazing.
Thank you, Sunil. It's been a pleasure.
Registration for the 2021 College Congress, which takes place between the 24th and 27th of May, is now open. This year, Congress will be fully virtual with all 30 hours of sessions being available on demand after the event. Pricing reflects the virtual nature of the meeting and is the lowest cost Congress in 15 years. As always, we'd love to hear from you. If you want to get involved, talk about your work, or have any feedback, send us a message at communications@rcops.ac.uk.